It is Saturday, March 23rd, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. I'm your host today, and in the second half of the show, we'll be taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can call us during that second half, 800-655-5877. Of course, that is toll-free. In the first half of the show, we'll be covering some geek news, and we're going to be focusing a bit, I think, on security today, unfortunately. Oh, my goodness. My name is Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me, a block from the beach on a sunny day in California, Santa Cruz, California, is Ben Jaffe. And Ben Jaffe is a broadcaster. No. Well, yeah, you are a broadcaster, but you're a web instructor and world traveler and a practicing and hopefully successful monotasker.
Yeah, I don't trust my brain to multitask. Yeah, you know, as the theme was playing just now, I was thinking, I feel weird. What's going on? I feel weird. Is it my headphones? Like, there's only one ear working, so I can hear both of us out of one ear. The music's blasting out of my left ear. I'm thinking, no, there's something else. I'm feeling naked. There's something I've forgotten. And then I realized, oh, I haven't plugged in my computer. I have 36% battery life. That's not enough to get me through Geek Speak. So, you know, you're introducing yourself, and I'm like bent over this chair trying to
plug
in.
Did you get plugged in? No, not yet. You're about to.
Let's see.
We'll watch. We'll listen to the calmness in his voice.
There we go.
And the little green light.
Hey, Ben, I
don't have power, so in halfway through the show, I'm going to take your power.
No. that works. You actually don't have power.
That's dope. But I'm getting air, so I probably have like 6 hours of battery time. The reason I'm unprepared is not because of power, but because this morning as I'm checking news at the last minute, as I normally do, I see this giant security vulnerability that Apple's talked about.
We're jumping right into that one
because it's on my mind. Severely, especially after...
Can I start with the less severe ones, then we'll end with
in a moment, we'll talk about the Apple security thing, which we are going to suggest you take action if you have an Apple account.
Yes. Ben. But first, I just want to mention Twitter. So it seems like everybody has a security issue this week, seriously. Twitter, Microsoft, LinkedIn, Yahoo, they all have security vulnerabilities. And they're all basically the same thing. Basically, it's if someone can intercept a cookie when you're logged in, which shouldn't be possible, but mm-hmm. is through a number of different potential vectors, then they can basically take over your account. They can be logged in as you, and even if you change your password, they're still logged in as you. Now, this isn't anything that's likely to happen to you, but it's just bad news, you know, that these things pop up like they do. And of course, it's security researchers that report on this news. So
every time you visit a page or do anything on a website, you're actually having a completely new experience every time. So the browser says, give me this, and then you get some stuff back, and then you say, give me this again. And the only way that the server on the back end knows it's the same person, and therefore knows that you're actually logged in already, is by saving this little piece of information called a cookie.
Yes.
And in that cookie, we hold some session information. So theoretically, the second after you log in and you get that session, and they go, oh, Ben is logged in to geekspeak.org. After you've done that, there's a little bit of code, that cookie on your machine, mm-hmm. that identifies you completely uniquely as Ben. And every time I see that cookie, I don't have to ask if you're Ben. I can just go, oh, you're Ben. And mm-hmm. then I give you information.
Yeah, it's an assumption that we make for convenience, because
yeah.
otherwise you'd have to re-log into Facebook every single time
That's
you ever want to change a page. Yeah.
Right. And so if I'm able as a third party, or you know, someone else is able to look at your information and traffic or look on top of your machine and get that cookie, and then they act as you on my site completely.
Yeah.
Now, there are some ways to detect this that make it better, but the general default technology is such that if you don't have HTTPS on, it's very easy to steal someone's sessions. And this is the vulnerability we've seen, and why over the years we've seen all these services move to HTTPS, which is Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure. And it's actually using a technology called TLS. It used to be SSL, but they're very close in
nature.
Wow,
acronym soup here.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Secure Sockets Layer. I don't know what TLS stands for. You know, I was thinking about doing like a little throwdown about acronyms with you, like really fast with CRT. And then you say...
cathode ray tube.
Nice. And then I say, T, there's a T in there, TV.
TV? Television?
Not actually an acronym, right? It's a concatenation.
No, that's a...
But anyway,
that's
we'd throw
a sad
back,
acronym.
We throw back these terms, and then you have to think of another... another one that has T and V in it.
TRS.
Or T or V. Oh, good. And I don't know what TRS stands for. Oh, yeah, it's a tip ring sleeve. Good.
Yeah.
TRRS.
I'd really be surprised if we have more than half of the original listeners to this show.
Oh, I know.
Right now.
It's great, right? Anyway, that was the game I was thinking of earlier today.
Yeah.
That's why I don't make games. Any case,
on
back
a road
to
trip?
The session stealing.
Very geeky road trip.
Why are all these people having the same... Why are Twitter and LinkedIn and all these different services having this problem? What's going on?
I mean, web services work in a particular way, and there are some best practices, and everyone tends to do roughly the same thing for security, right? And so when there's an issue with the way that everyone does security, then everyone is affected, right? But this isn't really the big news for me. The big news for me is a serious, serious security hole with Apple IDs. And yeah, we were talking about this a bit before the show. It's pretty bad. Basically, if anyone has your birthday and your email address, then they can fairly easily, fairly trivially compromise your account.
Take over
the
your
entire
Apple
thing.
Account.
Change your password, do whatever.
And basically own your Apple account and therefore own all the content you've bought through Apple.
And that's really bad, especially because in addition to all of the services Apple provides, one of them is email.
Yeah.
So that means that password resets for other services could go to your @me account, @me.com right. account. There's a little bit of good news in this, which is that Apple recently rolled out two-step verification. Two-step authentication is something Google has had for a very long time. I don't know how long, but more than 6 months, definitely. And that's basically where if you want to log in and they think, huh, this is weird, you know, you're logging in from Australia. Why are you logging in from Australia? Then they can verify you with a second step. They can send a text message to your phone or something like that and say like, hey, type in the code we just texted you. And of course, an attacker probably doesn't have physical access to your phone. So
and theoretically, you actually have to have physical access. And one of the security concepts is makes things safe by things you know or things you have. And it's best to do both.
Yes.
And so the things you know is the password, the things you have is your phone. And
absolutely.
If you do both those things. So this announcement says, you know, basically it's a very kind of now popular webpage that describes exactly how to steal someone's account, Apple account, through this process.
Mm-hmm.
So I, as a pseudo public figure and, you know, having a few followers on Facebook and Twitter and such, my birthday is probably known. In fact, it was last week. And so it would, you know, make a few guesses.
Oh,
and
happy
you know,
birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
I apparently don't follow this.
Well, I didn't make a big deal of my birthday this year, partially because you don't want everybody to know what it is. But
yeah.
It's probably trivial to find my birthday online.
Of course.
So that's a little disturbing. And my email address, of course, I own my own domain. Right? So it's my name.
Yeah.
Right. So basically, you know my name and you know my birthday. It's pretty easy to get my account. So I go on Apple.
How did you deal with this?
Okay. So the only way to deal with this is to turn on two-step authentication. So
yeah.
I thought, gosh, before we talk about this on GeekSpeak today, I better do that.
And you know what
so
I did?
Maggie
I did the same. I tried to do the same thing.
So Maggie and I jump on the Apple accounts and we go ahead and start doing this authentication process. And so to turn on two-step authentication, as you said, after the step, they're going to send me a piece of information, which is like a recover ID. And this thing you print out or save somewhere and put it away safe in a safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
That's one option. And then you get a password. You have to set your password to be really good. And their rule is horrible. It's not length.
Yeah.
It's about obscurity. You've got to have a capital. You've got to have a number
in
it.
One number, two letters, one uppercase and one lowercase,
yeah.
Which is
I did a screenshot of that because I was just so upset about it.
Stupid. I'm looking at a screenshot of it. And it cannot contain three consecutive and identical characters.
Right.
So arbitrary rules.
Arbitrary rules
that don't
theoretically make it more complicated, but it's only harder for a human brain. Not
yeah,
for
you
want
to make it more difficult for a computer to guess, which means just a longer password.
Yeah,
not
just
really
long,
arbitrary
you know?
Rules or anything.
And
like
I agree that it should have something like 8-9 unique things in it, and it should have, I don't know, make it 15 characters long. There.
Yeah.
Done. Stop. In the story. Let's keep going. But the other thing is any kind of rule abstraction they do where they say no repeated characters. Well, now someone that wants to try to crack that password, all they have to do is know those rules and obey those rules. And they drop a whole bunch of potential content,
yeah.
potential passwords out of the system. Anyway, didn't like that. And then the third thing, of course, is that they're going to have your mobile number so they can send you an ID. So every time you log in that they don't trust, as you said, they send you something on your phone and you have to have your password. So both those things to log in.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they won't do that. Sometimes they'll go, oh, this is the same machine you've been locking in for a long time. No big deal. Any case, so we set it up. You, me, and my partner Maggie, we all changed our stuff this morning. And right after we changed it, it says, just wait Three days.
Sorry, you can't change it right now. You need to wait 3 days before you do
Which, of course, is a safety measure so that no one hijacks your account by getting access to your machine.
Yeah, it says you must wait 3 days to enable two-step verification. This waiting period helps to ensure that no one other than the owner of this Apple ID can set up two-step verification. The problem is, if you wait 3 days and someone tries to compromise your account, you might no longer be the owner of the Apple ID.
Right, so the next problem... So it's a big problem. And of course, for me, I'm going, but everybody knows my email address and everybody knows my birthday.
So you're particularly vulnerable.
So are you. I mean, I know your birthday. I know the month of your birthday. You don't, maybe
a lot of
year too.
Okay, but check this out. See, this is so.
Okay, but wait. Let me describe what I did.
No, wait. Describe what you did in a second. For a long time now, I've had my birthday not online. Or I don't put my birthday online on Facebook, on Google Plus, on, you know, all of these various services. I change it. So it's kind of roughly within the same ballpark, but it's not actually the day. And this means that, of course, people who don't know me very well think that my birthday is blah, 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 or blah, 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 and they wish me happy birthday on the wrong days. And that's, you know, kind of funny and everything.
Yeah,
people
sure.
get offended. Like, how could you do this to me? But I mean, I started thinking like, am I just crazy? Am I being really paranoid? I mean, from what I can tell, banks use your date of birth as a security question, basically, right? They ask you to validate this and your date of birth. Apparently, so does Apple. And, you know, now I'm sitting back like, haha, none of you know my birthday. But everyone knows your birthday, or everyone can figure out your birthday, probably. So what did you do to deal with this?
Everybody potentially knows my birthday. My email address I mention every once in a while. And I've got like 6 emails, so you'd have to step through. But it's only a matter of time before someone cracks it. It'd be easy if they wanted to. Now, the other thing is, this probably isn't scripted yet. And therefore, it's most likely that someone have to want to do this. So, of course, I control my own domain name. So I turn on accept all email addresses to my domain name.
So that way you don't
I'm going to collect a lot of spam.
Emails and stuff.
Right. And then I made a password type email.
So you made... an email that was a bunch of random... Did you just make a bunch of random characters email?
I used one password, which is a password manager, to generate a string that was really long, and I used that as my email address. Now, I don't...
So, crazy long string at yourdomain.com is now your Apple email valid... Your recovery
it
email.
It made... Well, except that it has to be my it's my username, too. I got a little problems with it. I don't know how to log into Apple right now. But the point is, people can't steal it, and I can take care of it. You know, I just have to find it. It's a pain, though. Apple's
going
to fix this, obviously. They have to fix it. The thing that's strange to me is that they have my credit card information on file. Like, there's other piece of information they have. They have my home address. They have more attributes than just my birthday and my email address.
So why don't they make you validate those?
They should. They should really enable it. Hopefully the stress of the press will allow Apple to fix this. That would be nice.
And
it.
Apple and all of these companies tend to not have great track records unless everyone's really upset about it. The more people know, the quicker they'll fix it. You know, because it's really a cost-benefit analysis for them.
Right.
So, bad news.
I know.
Makes me sad.
All right, what's your next news story, sir?
Oh, well, I was actually going to bring up a birthday thing, but I'm not going to tell you the actual birthday because we don't want anyone to compromise the account of this. It is the birthday, the 20th birthday of the Intel Pentium chip, the 66 megahertz Intel Pentium chip. So you remember back in the day, the 486 chips and everything. They released the Intel Pentium chip. It was 5 times faster. Do you know why it's called the Intel Pentium instead of the 586? Because they were naming them 186, 286.
I'm assuming just a naming.
486.
But just, you know, for
you
fun.
You can't patent 586 as a name.
Why?
But you, U.S. law.
Ah,
but
okay.
You can.
So they started doing it for patents. That
Intel
makes sense.
Pentium. Yeah.
Okay.
And this is about the same time you started seeing Intel Inside stickers, just to kind of date that. That's 20 years ago. That's insane.
That's insane.
Yeah.
So wait, you said 20 years ago. That means we kind of know when their birthday is.
Okay, I'll just tell you because I don't think the Intel Pentium chip has an Apple ID. Uh-huh. But it was yesterday, March 22nd, 20 years ago.
Wow, 20 years.
That's crazy. And, you know, as much as we joke about how I'm like 10 years old on the air, I mean, I remember that, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I believe you do. All right. So something I went through this. So I did this event. and at UCSC. I'm retiring, and actually this next week is my last week at UCSC. Very sad. I've been talking about it for months, though, so probably everybody that listens to the show regularly has probably stopped listening. But one of the things I did is I had to edit some video together, and I have traditionally, I mean, the past 2 years had a lot of frustration in video editing, because I have some video editing chops. I've done multi-camera re-edits and, voiceover work.
Yeah, both
and,
of us have.
Both of us done that. You teach video editing, so you're a little more skilled than I. But over the years, I don't buy Final Cut anymore. I don't have an old version of Final Cut on my current computer, and the new version stinks.
Final Cut being the video editing software.
By
or
Apple.
One of the
right.
software
and
solutions.
The one I used to use. And then iMovie has gotten really bad, and I used to keep old copies, but now I can't anymore. And so those go away. I hate that. So I'm looking around and thinking, and the thing that I do, I do have the Adobe Suite. And Adobe Suite has Premiere.
Yes.
And so I normally actually didn't install Premiere in my Master Collection thing, and finally was like, you know what, I should have this. So I grabbed Premiere to edit a video, and I want to love it, but it's got some pain points, mostly because I don't know it, and it's confusing, right? You know, you can't throw a video.
Well, you're used to Final Cut.
I know.
So anytime you switch products,
anytime
you're going to have an issue.
But the point to me is that I think Apple's losing on this stage. I think but maybe it's just era of people that like want to separate the audio track, edit both the files, and re-merge the audio track and things of that nature, which you just, I don't know if you can do that in iMovie, but if you can,
I
think it's like removing your eyebrows. It just doesn't feel good.
You know, iMovie 07 HD, do you remember that?
Sure.
It was a great video editor. And then they came out with iMovie 08. And I think what happened is they realized, oh boy, we just made a product called iMovie, which ships free with Macs, and it's almost as good as Final Cut. So we have to like cripple this thing. And so iMovie 08 came out, and they're like, new feature, no more timeline, which is like the main part of the interface. Like that's what makes the video.
It's like the video editing is about sequential time.
Hey,
like,
guess
that's
what?
It's all about.
Video editing with no more time element. You don't
It'll
have to worry
easier.
About that annoying time thing. You know, just
oh man,
oh god. So anyway, that happened, and that's ever since iMovie has never quite been the same. You know,
so true. So
if only iMovie 07 HD would still work on our machines, that'd be great.
Oh man, I hope that Apple changes this thing. I have this stress point in the back of my head that Apple's not changing it, and that maybe
the security thing.
Well, so I go, I mean, the problem with the whole password change thing and my email address thing is, I know there's ways to detect what email addresses are on my server, and I'm not sure because I don't host my own mail server anymore. I used to, manage my own mail server and stuff. Now I use a hosting provider, but all this stuff is easy to determine. Like if I were to try to crack into my account right now without knowing this information, I might be able to do
it. You might be able to do it. Yeah,
and that's really aggravating. So I'm thinking, wait a second, Apple sent a confirmation email to that new address. I had to then click on it. That was all secure. I was at home through HTTP because I have an Air. I don't have Ethernet anymore. But that's okay because I was using HTTPS, right? Like I'm going through a whole step process in my mind of like what. Anyway, go to Apple. If you have an account at Apple, go to Apple and start and initiate two-step authentication. But please, please, please understand their warnings. Yeah. The other thing to do, of course, is to change your birthday. But don't change it to a date where you're under 18 because then everything stops working.
Okay. So, two things. Seriously, go to apple.com and do that if you have a what are they called now? Mobile, not mobile me, mobile.mac, something. I don't know. Whatever it is, I always forget the name because they've changed their names like five times or three times in the last several years. But anyway, if you have an account with Apple, go to their website, turn on two-step auth or two-step verification right now. Like, do it. Seriously. Now, good news, actually. I didn't think of this until now. Good news. If you have no idea what your Apple password is and you can't go restore your email because you don't have access to your old email account or something like that, go ahead and take advantage of the security vulnerability and regain access to your account, right? Anyway, so, yeah. We've already come back to this once. Let's leave this topic in the past.
So, leaving that topic in the past, leaving the video editing. So, the other thing, what I was going to say, Ben, is I think there's an opportunity right now. If people want to do a little more serious editing, that's the thing, is that people want to do simple editing, we'll do the same thing that I did. You'll go, this will be easy, and you'll jump into iMovie because it's free on your Mac, if you're in a Mac environment, and you'll edit for a while until you get frustrated, then you'll give up on what you're trying to do, and you'll just publish what you had.
Yeah.
Right?
And you won't have any hair left either.
Right. And so, I went to Premiere, of course, and in Premiere, there was just some stuff that I wanted. You know, some things that aren't nice. You can't drag a handle to fade the video at the end. You know, like how you can normally drag a track.
You can't do that in Final Cut.
No, you can't. But it's these features that should be there. Like,
yeah,
there should be better.
They're there in Logic Pro.
So
I
ask everybody to send me, if you have a good video solution, good video editing solution that you really love, above Premiere, above Final Cut, above iMovie, that you love on your environment, please do send me an email. My email is... Sorry, I couldn't resist. Go to geekspeak.org and send us an email. And we're actually geeks at geekspeak.org. And tell us what your favorite video editing platform is, because I would love to know a good one. I'll pay for it.
What I wish was still around? Did you ever use Vegas?
Oh, yeah. Vegas
by Sonic
Video.
Foundry?
No, I was cleaning out my office, right? And I pull out some CDs, and one of it's like Vegas Video 4. I'm like, that's a good video editing. I have to run Windows 98. I don't think I can do that.
I know.
I totally did that. Totally.
They started as an audio thing, looping and, you know, the...
Do you know how many things on my machine are authenticated off my Apple ID? Because my machine knows. I see all these error messages popping in front of me going, FaceTime no longer enabled messaging.
Like during the show
Of course, right now. All right. Well, why wouldn't it be right now? Yeah. All right. Video editing done. Next news story, sir.
Cross it out. Okay.
Crossing it out.
So,
Oh, you know what I should probably do?
Yeah.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Ben Jaffe. We are taking calls in just a moment. 800-655-5877. Again, that's 800-655-5877. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. Now, Ben, I've been hearing a lot of scary stuff about Google Keep. What's going on, man?
What is Google Keep anyway? Okay, so there's so many stories about Google Keep. Google Keep is a new product that Google released. It's part of Google Drive, and basically, my take on it is they're trying to find a way for people to jot down things really quickly and get them into Google Drive, because they want people to use Google Drive. Google Drive used to be Google Docs, and now it stores all your documents,
yes.
It stores images, what all that stuff, right? But all of the tech reporting people have sent out articles that are all about how Google Keep is an Evernote killer and all that. So Evernote is a note-taking application that and so much more. I really, really like it. There are some things that irritate me about it. I wish there was a better another competitor to kind of keep them more relevant. But everyone in the tech reporting world is comparing Google Keep to Evernote and talking about it as an Evernote killer, or is it going to replace Evernote, or Google Keep sucks because Evernote's so much better. And I'm just kind of, I guess the takeaway for me is I'm really tired of the state of tech news reporting. I mean, along with science news reporting and medical news reporting and just general news reporting, I mean, they get a lot of things wrong, you know, and they make a lot of assumptions and things like that. So if you see news stories about how Google Keep sucks because Evernote is better or something like that, you can just ignore those.
Well, also, Google Keep's not available on iOS yet.
It is.
Is it?
No, it's not. You're right. I think it's not.
It probably will. But basically, what we're talking about is an app for your phone that allows you to take notes, and it syncs it to your Google account through Google Drive so that all your devices, you have notes at the same time. This is what Evernote is famous for.
Yeah.
I have used Evernote in the past, but I don't currently use it.
It is a web app that you can use on iOS, but not a native app right now. There are a couple articles I'm going to put up on the GeekSpeak site if you're interested in Google Keep. It's kind of comparing Google Keep to Evernote to Apple Notes. Evernote recently had a security breach. Passwords were stolen, but they were encrypted, and probably they're not going to even be able to crack it. The Evernote team did a really good thing, I think. They decided to make a mandatory password change.
We talked about that last week.
That last week. So anyway, there's the whole, like, I don't know, is Evernote secure thing? What are the positive things about Google Keep? What are the positive things about Apple Notes? I'll put that up. And then there's also another question that people are asking. This is, I think, a really bad time for Google to have decided to launch a new product, because they just closed down Google Reader.
Right.
And everyone's really upset about that and annoyed about that. And so a lot of people are kind of bitterly being like, well, Google Keep's new, but how long is it going to be around? You know, just wait until they decide to close it out. And some people have done some interesting analyses of this. For example, they took... a writer wrote an article and took a lot of Google's dead projects and looked at their lifespans and figured out that the average life expectancy of a Google app, which is currently dead, is about
a Google product.
A Google product, except for the ones that are still around. I mean, Gmail, you know, is still around. So it didn't make this list, obviously.
Yeah,
so it's
average?
A little bit biased, right, in that way. But about 1,500 days, about a little, about 4 years.
Yeah.
So 4 years, and then Google tends to let products go.
I mean, one of the reasons why there's so many different products is that Google wants to innovate, right? So they give a lot of space for their developers to make new products, and they're not normally sure how they're going to work, function, all that on a on a full-scale thing. They're not doing like a waterfall-type development cycle, right? They're looking in the future about what potential customers would have. They just start creating stuff, and then if it takes off in a way that they can make money on it, they continue it. So that kind of development environment, that research kind of project, of course, is going to lead to a lot of dead products.
Absolutely. In Google's defense, everyone else does that too. Everyone kills off a project that isn't making them money or that not many people use anymore. So, I mean, I don't know. It's not so much of an evidence-based criticism as it is just a frustration-based criticism. So,
if you're affected, you get frustrated, that's for sure. And everything that we do talk about is up at geekspeak.org by the end of the show. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. And in the other room is Rick. And Rick is taking calls. He will answer the phone. And if you tell him what your problem is, your question, your comment, he'll type that up briefly and send it to us and then pipe you through to this board, and I'll put you on air. And all you have to do that is have a question or a comment about technology, and you can give us a call at 800-655-5877. I'll give it that number again, 800-655-5877. Ben, do you know that number by heart?
800-655-5877. But you know what's
That was
kind
so
of,
fast.
You know what's funny is if I'm out of the air room, I can figure out the number if I only if I say, or toll free at 800-655.
Because I always say
it's
that.
It's a memory. It's a muscle memory thing.
You know, my father actually said, every time you say the phone number, say toll-free at. We used to have two phone numbers, right? The other phone numbers, 476-2800. That's only in the 831 area code. And I used to use that for years. And finally, I was like, maybe we should just give one phone number. It works everywhere. Mm-hmm. Less confusing. But I always still keep toll-free at. Which just comes from my father. Isn't that exciting?
The European Space Agency's Planck mission. It's a satellite. Basically, what it does is it scans the entire sky. By sky, we mean night sky, right? Over and over and over and over and over again. And it looks at the radio and the microwave emissions from the early universe, right? Light from the early, early, early universe. And some interesting, we've been getting a lot of interesting findings from these kinds of observations. One of the things that we've found quite a while ago is that the light from the early universe shows that the universe itself is actually not smooth. And so actually I'm going to put a really fantastic article up on the GeekSpeak site that I would recommend any of you space nerds to read, but I'll just go ahead and tell you what the takeaways from the new data from the Planck mission is. Or are, I suppose. First of all, the universe is 13.82 billion years old. And this was, before we thought it was 13.73 billion years old. So we're about 0.1, we're about 100 million years off, right?
Yeah.
But of course, that was within our margin of error from the WMAP spacecraft when we looked at it earlier. So we know that the universe is a little bit older than we thought it was. We also know that the universe is expanding a little bit more slowly than we expected it was. We also have new numbers about the percentages, basically the makeup of the universe. So before, we had slightly different numbers to this, but now we know that the normal matter only comprises 4.9% of the universe. So think about that.
Wow.
Everything that we can see.
And we really know what it is.
Period. Which is way beyond the grasp of our comprehension. I mean, we can't even comprehend the size of our own little dinky planet, which is inside of a solar system, inside of a galaxy. You get the idea. 4.9% of the universe is normal matter. And we actually thought that was a little bit higher before. We also know that it's 26.8% dark matter, which is this stuff that we kind of know what it is. We kind of don't really know what it is, but we know we can observe it by the way normal matter interacts with it gravitationally, because this stuff has a gravitational well.
I don't mean to be pedantic, but I think the better way to describe it is a name for a gravitational effect we observe.
It is a name for
A gravitational. We see the only thing we know about it is that it has a gravitational effect. Like, that's what we know.
Well, that's the way that we can observe it.
Right.
But
you
I
say,
mean, mathematical models and things, I mean, we can infer other things about it.
But the only thing we know about it is its gravitational effect. But go on.
The only thing we can observe.
And, yeah. But yeah. You were saying, I'm sorry.
Pedantic, whatever. and then 68.3% dark energy, which we really don't have much of an idea. A lot of people will describe it as a pressure. That's kind of the thing that keeps the universe expanding and actually accelerates the expansion of the universe.
Right.
But, you know, what's interesting is... So Phil Plait, the guy who wrote this.
Awesome. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Such a great guy. He said the best estimates were a little different. And he gives the percentages. He says, that's neat. There's less dark energy than we thought. So the universe is made up of a little less of that weird stuff, if that makes you feel better. Right? But there's still, I mean, it's still a ton of it. It's yeah. still like... About over two thirds of the universe.
Okay, so
is dark energy.
I want to.
We have no idea what it is.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
It's exciting stuff.
We are taking calls, but we have no one calling in, which, you know, is actually quite rare for us. Maybe there's something
yeah,
off the phone.
Is.
Normally we have a few people.
Maybe
waiting.
I'll call. I guess
you
I
could
can't.
Call in.
I
no,
can't
no,
call
it'd,
in.
It'd make a difficult conversation. Yeah. But other people can call in if they know the number.
Yeah, that's true. Which is 800-655-5877.
To be clear, it's toll free at 1-800-655. 5877. Wouldn't it be funny if we actually forgot the number and we've been saying the wrong number the whole day? That'd be great.
I was actually just thinking that, like, you pointed at me and I started to say the number. I'm like, wow, I just need to stay on autopilot. I can't think about this consciously.
So I want to mention something.
Yeah.
You mentioned WMAP a moment ago for a telescope.
So, I don't know how to say those acronyms. Do you pronounce them or do you say them? Or
well, it's
WMAP?
A Wilkins Microwave Astronomy Probe.
Yeah. Okay.
And Astrob. Yeah.
I've got another piece of space
yeah,
news
please.
As well, which is that Voyager 1, the spacecraft that we launched decades ago, has officially left the solar... Well, maybe it hasn't left the solar... Gosh, I don't know. We've been reporting on this for ages.
It's and slowly it's been, crawling
it's
out.
It's been leaving the solar system over and over and over again. So basically, there was a paper that I think I reported on... earlier when it actually happened, about how Voyager 1 had left the solar system and all that stuff. And the news is that the paper that talked about that got peer-reviewed and got released and everything like that. So then I read this and I was like, oh, that's exciting. It's officially left. Now we're interstellar, right? But there's actually correction. NASA, JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the Voyager project scientist Ed Stone said, among other things, quote, it's the consensus of the Voyager science team that Voyager 1 has not left the solar system or reached interstellar space. So one of the things that makes this really difficult is, like, what is the heliosphere and how is it defined and when do we cross it?
Right.
And, you know, like, maybe the line
isn't this
so...
just science... pedantism. I mean, yeah, it's there's
well,
a
I mean,
space where it's outside and there's a space where it's inside.
It's like, is Pluto a planet or not? You know, like, at some point
definition.
We need to define things by creating what are kind of arbitrary rules. I mean, Pluto is a rock in space. Earth is a rock in space. What makes one different from the other? Well, I don't know, the way we perceive them, right? Yeah. So anyway.
There's like a lot of things that make a difference, but yes, you're right, the way we perceive
but,
them.
But they're all just differences in the way we perceive them.
All right.
So anyway,
well, that request for phone calls, guess
it
what
worked.
It did? Oh yeah.
Oh really?
Big time, sure. Why wouldn't it? All right, from Santa Cruz, Don, welcome to Geek Speak.
Okay, you just mentioned one of you, not Lyle, but the other guy just
yeah,
mentioned
Ben.
The dark energy. One of the things we may know about it is it may be what is supplying the pressure to create the expansion of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I got a problem with that.
You know, Don, when he said it, I thought, oh, I should rephrase that like I did a second ago, being pedantic.
Okay,
so I'm
well,
glad I'm not doing it.
You
please,
were just
Don.
Talking about that?
Please, Don, go ahead.
Okay. Here's my little bit. It's if the universe started with an explosion and the explosion was in space, it's going to just keep on exploding. It doesn't need anything added.
Uh-huh.
There's no pressure required.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
No, that's not what I had a problem with. First off, there wasn't an explosion in space. Space
well, all
expanded.
Right. It was an explosion out of space. How about that?
And then, Ben, Please address Don's concern.
Wait, so your concern is...
His thought is, why does there need to be any... So if there was an explosion, if we think about the beginning of the universe as an explosion, which we shouldn't because it's not, but if we think of it that way, and there would be no friction to it expanding forever, why do we have to have this idea of dark energy that expands it? Can't it just expand on its own?
Yeah, no pressure needed.
Okay, well, I think Ben will be able to address this very well. So go ahead, Ben.
So, are we done?
Yeah. No, you can stay. You want to say goodbye? That's fine.
I'll stay with you.
All right, stay on. Okay.
So yeah, two things. First of all, it wasn't an explosion in space. It was space itself that was exploding.
Right.
So, you know, the idea of friction only exists within a universe or something
so
like that.
Why do we need something else?
In addition to that, beyond that, the expansion of space itself is accelerating.
Right.
So we're not just, it's not just exploding at a constant rate. You know, at a velocity of
and so
an acceleration of zero, it's actually accelerating. It's getting faster and faster. It's accelerating slower than we thought it was accelerating previously. That's what the Planck things. Yeah.
But the point is that because it is accelerating in its expansion, we normally think of those kind of things as an added energy.
Yeah.
But this is this weird added energy that's kind of expanding it faster, so we call it dark energy.
That's the
Pedantic side of me went, well, it's not really that it's a thing that we then... It has this attribute. There's an attribute that we call this thing. Like that. That's the reason I call it differently.
Yeah.
I think of it differently. But we're learning about it all the time. Thank you so much, Don, for the clarification.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Oh, I love it when we get a call and we show how smart Ben is because he is pretty smart.
Oh, come now.
Yeah.
But
it's true.
You know what's so interesting about this? And we had Linda Carpenter, a particle physicist, on a long time ago, a good friend of mine.
Do a Google search on GeekSpeak and Linda Carpenter will get the show.
Yeah, but I remember at the beginning you asked like three questions and she was like, whoa. What? Those don't make any sense together because ultimately the way we understand the universe, and we especially see this when we're talking about things that are outside of our everyday perception. We understand them with metaphors. And so if we understand things that actually are a certain way with a metaphor that helps us better understand it, we're working within metaphor land. We're working within a symbolic world, right? It's not really reality. And so thinking about the Big Bang as an explosion in space, for example, that's a good way to explain it to people who aren't really into astronomy, right? But once you get past that metaphor, things get really confusing. And all of a sudden, things don't make any sense within our everyday world. You know, same with we were talking with Higgs boson with Linda Carpenter on that show. And
by the way, the show is called Practical Particle Physics. We always name GeekSpeak episodes in this insanely bad way. Ben helps.
I do not.
If you'd like to participate in naming GeekSpeak episode, all the stuff we talk about, we just kind of slam them together to make crazy sentences.
Yeah,
like practical particle physics. That episode is in 2009, July 11th, 2009. You can find it at geekspeak.org along with, 500 other episodes of GeekSpeak. And that show, it was actually, we linked to that recently for some other reason. I think it had to do with crazy robots. Anyway,
you know, I would also like to just say the last couple shows, a listener named Greg has been writing in with ideas, and we're loving it. It's great. So
yeah. If you, I mean, we really would love titles. They need to be short so that you can't lose them on the podcasting feeds.
Yeah.
And they have to be descriptive in the such that the idea is that if you've listened to the show and you see the title, you go, yeah, I think I saw that.
Is GeekSpeak Creative Commons?
It is, except for the beginning of the show when we play the theme. Yeah.
We're through being cool.
Yeah. Yeah, we are.
Yeah. We're too cool for Creative Commons. So, I mean, if you listening right now, I'm talking to you, yes, feel like contributing in any way. If you have any ideas, if you have any things you want to shoot, give to us or email to us, do it. You know,
yeah.
We'd love your feedback.
Geeks at geekspeak.org. And I'll read it if it doesn't look like a spam. Elizabeth from Aptos. Elizabeth, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Quite well.
Calling from my bi-weekly question.
Fantastic.
I mean. I want to label my photos with either, probably with my website as opposed to watermark, and I heard you can do it preview, but I cannot figure that out.
Oh.
I wondered if you know a good program for doing that, and I want it, you know, just a subtle kind of light thing on there, but I do want to...
You want to put your web address on your photo, so as your photos sped around, you luckily will hopefully get...
Do you have a PC or a Mac?
Gotcha.
I have a Mac.
And do you have Photoshop?
I do have Photoshop. All right.
It's kind of a pain, though, huh?
Photoshop, what's the one? Photoshop, I don't know. I never use
some,
it.
Yeah, some version CS something or something.
I have something. But there's a type of Photoshop that's kind of an abbreviated version.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see. What's that called? Photoshop.
Elements.
Elements.
So go on.
Yeah.
So she's got that. So can't she do it in that?
Yeah, you could do it in that. Another option is if you actually just do a Google search for Watermark Mac, you'll find a lot of free or relatively cheap applications that will allow you to add a watermark you've already created to a bunch of photos en masse, right? So
right, that's
a really good way to do it.
I was trying to do that with, I did find one called Star Watermark, which sort of worked, but then now it just won't size right. Like it just makes them really, really big or really, really small no matter what I do for some reason. The, you know, the website address, I don't know why.
Yeah, I found one called Photo Bulk. There are a lot of them. So, you know, just poke around. If you can find images that were created with that application, then you can see what the watermark would generally look like.
And
I'm sure a lot of them, some of them will let you size it better and some of them will be not so great.
And why aren't you just doing it with iPhoto?
With iPhoto?
What do you use to manage your...
I never learned how to use iPhoto.
Oh. What do you use to manage your photos on your computer? Meaning you copy them from your camera or copy them wherever you have them on your computer. What do you
manage
then use?
I don't manage them too well. I just put them in...
A folder?
Preview and like can never find what I want.
Okay. Since you're on a Mac, I would highly recommend you using iPhoto. Because
yeah, I think I need to... Well, that's a good question, actually. That is another question I didn't think of. Is there... I understood... iPhoto would be great to use, but if I want to take the thousands of photos I've already have, that would be really hard to transfer them over to that. Is that
so? True? No, that's not really true. I mean, if you have a little bit of a problem, iPhoto will scan your entire computer and copy the photos over, and you'll have a second copy, which kind of stinks. I think in the settings for scanning your entire computer, you can actually have them move, but then they'll be in a different place. But the point about all this is the file system is just not the best tool to manage photos. Now,
sure,
I'm somebody that has, you know, I have like 150,000 photos, and I have access to them right now with me all the time. And I use Lightroom, which is kind of a, I think it's like a little under $100 from
I've heard Lightroom's really good.
It's really quite good, but it's one of these things where once you commit to a system like that, I am trapped in that system, right? If I were in iPhoto, I'd also be trapped in it.
Right.
You're not trapped right now. You're in a file system thing of just a lot of pain. So you want
to
move to one
it's
of these management
to
tools.
Find something when I want something.
Just use iPhoto.
Though,
it's
you know,
not
named or whatever.
I recommend using iPhoto. If you've got a Mac, why not use it? It's
so
there.
Perhaps.
It's a lot better than the file system.
It's not difficult to take those and put them into that system. I mean, it's intuitive if I go to the program.
Yeah, open iPhoto, and I think it's going to be like import or search for photos. It's you know, it's going to be a simple thing. It's
and all the photos have their own metadata, so all of the dates and everything should line up properly and everything.
It's also called import to library.
Also, if you're using something like iPhoto or Aperture or Lightroom, there are plugins that you can either download. I'm not sure if they're free ones. You can certainly buy one, and I know that there are a number of them that'll let you watermark directly within that program.
Right. So, Lightroom has watermarking built in every time you export.
If I use iPhoto, then there's a way to watermark.
Yeah, there is. I don't use iPhoto. I actually use something else. You know, I use Lightroom. But yeah, there's easy ways to do it. And actually, it's only when you export the photo that you do that. So when you want to share the photo, you say, oh, watermark this when you export it. So the original doesn't get touched. Also, when you're importing in iPhoto, when you say import, you can pick your entire drive. It's going to find all the photos and import them, right? You don't have to go find them for it. You just let it scan. And keep in mind, the first thing you want to do before you do anything on your computer is and make sure your backup's up to date. And if you're not backing up every day, you should be, because your hard drive will fail and you'll lose all your data, especially photos.
Right.
Are hard for people. There's a little bit of my mantra. Thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate
it. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care. Bye. You are listening to Geek Speak. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. Rick is waiting for phone calls from you. Ben, the other tool that we didn't think to mention is Google's tool called Picasa.
Picasa, yeah.
It's quite good. People use it. And that's another one. It's probably hundreds of them. But
yeah.
We actually have another call. Elizabeth, thanks for the call. That was great. I love talking about photographs. It's always fun. From Monterey, Garland, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thank you very much. Appreciate taking the call. Mm-hmm. I'd love if you guys could do a quick explanation of the Automator application. How to use it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Ben. What you know about Automator Primer?
A little bit. I've kind of dabbled in it here and there. Basically, what it lets you do is it lets you automate various tasks on your Mac. So In fact, I'm opening it up right now.
It's a programming tool.
We can use that term loosely. It's not like diving into code and doing stuff. But I mean, like, for example, you can, I'm just reading through some of the things you can.
You could add watermark to photos.
You can add user accounts to your computer. You can add photos to an album. You can ask the user for something. You can burn a disk. You can do all these things, and you can take them and chain them up in a various ways to accomplish a larger task.
A workflow.
Yeah, a workflow. That's basically what you're doing.
Of any time you're doing something repetitive on your computer that you need to be able to do, you probably can do that in Automator. Now, this is only an OS X thing, right? It's only in Macs. But it's got this kind of cute little icon. It's a little frustrating. It's kind of akin to Apple Script in the sense that the idea is that an end user could do stuff on their machine. And it's you can actually run Apple Scripts through it. So it's just a great way to glue Apple Scripts together.
It's kind of a drag and drop Apple Script, if you will.
I've made Automator to do finds on my computer that I wanted to create, but
searches.
Yeah, but that didn't work well. I've done it. What else have I done? I think I've done imagery sizing, though. I really like a thing called Thumbnail, which is a really cool app.
I used Automator and a bunch of Automator files and Apple Scripts and everything that some other guy wrote.
I
kind of put them together in this interesting way so I could add keyboard shortcuts to answer Skype calls hang up Skype calls and to make certain Skype calls.
So Skype
is a really difficult program to script any way whatsoever. But it was really nice. I don't remember. I mean, but you can do all kinds of crazy things, like a window pops up and you know, you hit a keyboard shortcut which invokes an Automator folder actions and data. Like, it's a way of taking a bunch of things and kind of spit and glue them together.
So the thing is, we've probably given all the information that Garland already knows. Right, Garland? How do you learn how to use it? Every time I've tried to use it, I, as a programmer, get frustrated and I end up going down to some other language or some other environment that I can
understand. But you're a programmer.
There. Yes. So, I bet you there's good videos. In fact, I would suggest going to YouTube and search for learning Automator.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, actually, what I've had the most success with whenever I use Automator for anything is I search just like very specifically for what I want to do, see if anyone has already done it, right? If someone's already done it, I take what they do and I modify it, right? If I can't find anything there, I just make my search terms a little more general, a little more general. And eventually with the Skype example, for example, I couldn't find anyone who was doing what I wanted to do. And so I ended up just doing a very general search, and I ended up with probably 30, 40 browser windows open with all the different things that people had used Automator or Apple Script or shell commands or anything to do with Skype. And I just kind of looked at them all, figured out if there was a way that I could string them together in a haphazard way to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. And computers are fast, so even if it's a really roundabout way of doing something, it'll happen almost instantaneously. So you can basically augment your computer, your experience with your computer using Automator or Apple Script in that way.
Thank you so much for the call, Garland.
Yeah, sorry that Google searching is the only
horrible answer. It's one of the worst answers you could possibly give on radio.
The other thing to say is that
I like the idea of people thinking about making their computer do things for them rather than trying to do things that work on the computer. Like that idea, that switch is a very important switch. I think people need to grow up understanding that the computer is a tool that works for you. You don't always have to be stuck. And this is why there's a big, you know, the open source movement. Ideas. I wish we'd be able to change everything, which I totally agree with. I also really love good products. You know, I love Photoshop. Like, it's a great editor. And if I didn't have that editor, I'd make me sad. Even though I'm a programmer and I could probably program an editor to some degree. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's this, and GIMP is out there.
The GIMP.
Yeah. The GIMP. Oh, it's called The GIMP.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a photo editing tool, by the way. That's an open source photo editing tool. And it's actually quite impressive.
It's very, very impressive.
Photoshop was 6 years ago, and it always will be. So, the point about this mindset of the computer should be a tool that works for you is the way to make the tool work for you is to learn how to program. And if you don't think that's important, I urge you to go to code.org, and just watch their videos for a few minutes and understand that you're not really participating at a high level in our society, in our digital society, if you're not learning to program.
That's a big statement you just made.
I strongly agree that
you stand behind it.
I think it's more important to learn to program than to learn American history. There you go.
All right.
Well, No, I don't. I think it's it's hard to judge.
It's hard to pin yourself down on something like that when you're live on the air, isn't it?
Speaking of live on the air.
It's important.
Yes.
To code.
Speaking of live on the air, April in Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there, you guys. I was wondering if I could ask you a question about Yahoo Mail.
You know what? You can. Will you stay with me and I'll talk to you after the show?
You were talking about email earlier.
You know what? I just realized the time, though, April.
We just looked at the
clock. I'm going to have to ask you to call back the station. I'll talk to you directly and we will help you. But not on air. I'm so sorry because we're running out of time here on GeekSpeak today.